what are the signals that this is a product obsessed founder, that this founder is going to run through walls, that this founder is open to feedback and, you know, and coaching? Is this someone I want to be working with for potentially the next 10 years?
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, longtime executive coach and professional recruiter and best-selling author. Let's get into it.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace. I'm Carol Schultz. Today, we're exploring the hot topic of getting funded as a business. Any founders on the funding journey or curious to learn more about the ins and outs, this one is for you. And who better to join me than expert Seth Levine, one of the partners of Foundry, a well-known early-stage venture capital firm, and a guy I've known for, I think, somewhere north of 20 years.
At least.
Yeah. So, Seth, thanks for joining me our second time having you on. But before we get into today's topic, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Foundry?
Sure. So Foundry is a venture capital firm based out of Boulder. We invest directly into companies, early stage technology businesses. Typically, our entry is Series A, maybe Series B. So companies that have some market traction, what you would call, I guess, product market fit, you know, maybe some early data on go to market, things like that. And we also invest in other venture funds. So we have a portfolio of really seed stage venture funds. We've got about 50 in the portfolio, and we manage about $3.5 billion in total. And I've been with Foundry since we started it. I was one of the co-founders of the firm.
Yeah, which is fantastic. So in our first episode, we explored your journey as a leader. And now I want to pick your brain a little bit and talk to you about getting funded on behalf of many founders seeking answers to these questions, right? How to do it? What do I need to do? You know, so on and so forth. So let's start here. At what point in the process of building a company do you recommend leaders start thinking about funding?
Yeah.
So maybe bootstrapping. I mean, I just read somebody on LinkedIn who posted that they had just taken funding after being sure they were going to bootstrap their company all the way.
I mean, I would start that. Well, first of all, I'd say, so I just went through this process myself. So I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The New Builders. It's got me thinking a little bit about how we fund Main Street businesses. And one of the things that we write about in the book is there's this funding gap. So I won't go all the way in it, but I started a fintech business to help solve that problem. And so I just went through like a pre-seed round myself. And that included talking to some, you know, early stage VCs. Ultimately, I did a friends and family round. So I'm just like pretty, that was like Q4 last year. So that's pretty fresh in my mind. So I've been now on both sides of the table. And I obviously, like 20, 30 years ago, I'd raised money for some other businesses I worked for before I became a venture capitalist. But that was like so long ago, not even to be relevant. But the first thing I always tell people is don't take money from VCs. Like, it's a terrible bargain, right? Like, you're trading, you know, the valuations aren't great. You're, you know, whether you sell 10% or, you know, 70% of your business, the VCs still, you know, still control quite a bit. Right. There's a clock that starts to tick on you because venture funds are typically 10, 12 years, maybe they stretch a little bit longer, but like at some point the VC needs to get their money out. Your investors need to get their money out. And, you know, the way to do that isn't just dividend money out and you know, they still have ownership. The way to do that is you sell your business, right? Or go public, I suppose, if you get big enough. And so the first thing I say to people is like, your default should be like, I definitely do not want to do that, right? Like, the cheapest money that you can get is like, find a customer that's willing to pay you to build the thing that you want to build. Not always easy to do, but I've seen a lot of businesses start that way, right? You kind of scrap something together, you find someone who's willing to pay a little bit for it, and you just sort of increment up. I guess that's bootstrapping, right? And then the second way is if you have it available to you, either fund it yourself in some way. Most commonly, that's credit cards or even a home equity line, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving financial advice, but that is a way that people do this. Maybe it's friends and family. It's what we did for my lending startup. And but part of that is, you know, we might want to run this business for 20 years. And so we didn't necessarily want to have the clock ticking. And then like the very last choice would be to take money from a VC. Now, there's lots of great reasons to take money from a VC, including you're building a product that's highly technical and it requires a lot of development before you can get it launched. Right. Or there's something about the product that you're building that's highly capital intensive, right? We see that in AI all the time, or you see it in AI now, right? That's why they're raising so much money, or at least they were before these open source models got so good and so open sourcely free. But those are good reasons. And then sometimes it's simply you want the expertise and advice of a VC, right? I mean, the things that we bring to the table when we join a company's board and join a company's cap table are years and years of experience, sometimes operating experience, but lots of venture experience as well. Portfolios of companies. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of startups that we've been involved with. You get to be part of the network of that venture firm, and that can be very helpful to have those sorts of peer relationships. In fact, those are the kind of relationships you should seek out whether or not you take money from, you know, from an institutional source. And then, of course, you get the network of the venture capitalists. Right? Most VCs are relatively well-networked. Maybe that's with customers. Maybe that's with partners. Certainly, that's with downstream capital sources. Obviously, you know, most of us who have been in the business for any period of time have a lot of experience, you know, exiting companies, going public with companies, things like that. So if those are things that you value and need, those are all really good reasons to take money from a VC. Or maybe you have a freemium model, or there's some network benefit to your business where the product itself becomes more powerful the more people that are using it, and you need the money to run the servers and do the marketing. And so those are all real reasons. But the default should be, I don't want to do that. Is there any way I can avoid?
Right.
I mean, you didn't for your business, right? I mean, you've
well, you were no, running... but I went out and got a loan.
Yeah.
Right. So I went through, when I made a pivot, I went through, I mean, the reason I had delayed even doing the pivot is because I was making too much money. And I thought, I'm going to go broke in the meantime now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to rebuild all that. So, you know, and in doing that and investing, starting with my book, you know, that was, came out almost 3 years ago, and then pivoting the business and so on. And you know, sometimes you make a mistake, you have to do tweak here, you have to tweak there. You know, you're not, that of course is not a foreign for you to hear that, because that happens frequently with companies. Well,
what you're describing is actually interesting. Like, one of the hardest things I think for companies to do in general is to disrupt themselves. And the reality is that if you're going to run a business for any reasonable period of time, at some point you're going to have to do something that feels like you're disrupting yourself.
You know, my wealth manager said to me one day, "What's your plan B, Carol?" I said, "Don't have one."
And you said, you quoted Will Smith and you said, "No plan B, it distracts from plan A," right?
Right. Basically, that's exactly right. But what kind of participation are you doing in this sort of seed fund that you mentioned?
Yeah. So, I mean, our seed managers are completely independent of us. So, you know, they oftentimes we, you know, they talk to us, they ask us questions, things like that. I've done plenty of seed investments in my life, both right. as a personal investor and institutionally. When Foundry was started way back in 2007, we were doing seed and Series A. We did a bunch of seeds. In fact, my very first Foundry deal ever that I led was a seed deal. This will tell you how long ago it was. We did $500,000. Another venture firm, Spark Capital, did $500,000 at a 3 million post into an ad tech business way back in the day. And that business eventually, like 5 years later, sold for $500 million. So it was a very good deal.
Very nice.
But that was back when that was what seed was. Now seed these days, institutional valuations are quite a bit higher than that. But anyway, so I do have plenty of experience, you know, at the seed level. But with our underlying funds, you know, we try to provide a framework of support. We connect them with each other. Obviously, they connect with us directly, but you know, we're hiring or we're investing in managers that are experienced, and then they kind of know what they're doing. They each have a different strategy, and they go execute that strategy. Sometimes we're on their LP advisory committee, which is sort of the equivalent of a, not quite a board, but sort of like an advisory board, essentially, somewhere between a board and advisory board, right. Of a handful of funds. So we're a little bit more involved in those funds. And you know, I think because we're general partners, we're venture investors ourselves, maybe we get more calls than the average investor, you know, average limited partner, average investor in a venture fund gets, because you know we have the same job that our underlying fund managers have as well. Right. So I think are less scary to call.
Got it. I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about pre-seed and seed funding.
Yeah, let's.
You know, for those who are looking for their sort of initial, how am I going to get money to get this started? And do you tend to see, especially in pre-seed, any product whatsoever? They have an MVP? I mean, you know.
More typically, yes, but it depends. Depends a little bit on what your background is. It depends a little bit on what type of product you're building. But most often, the team has come together and there's at least some initial product. And that doesn't necessarily need to be fancy, but especially these days, like building a prototype using AI tools is not that hard to do, right? You and I can do that relatively simply. Now, the expectation is that will get completely rewritten, as you really figure out what's the, you know, the scale version of that product. But having something in the market, having done real product research, having talked to actual customers, having probably talked to some synthetic customers, by which I mean using AI tools to essentially impersonate your customers and ask it questions, really interrogate it. Like, those are things that everyone should do before you quit your day job, right? Like, if you're going to start a business, like, there are so many more tools now that you can use that are really effective. And I want to be careful. It's so cliche to be like, oh, just go ask AI. But if you're being smart about it, there are great ways to use AI, especially at this like super, super early stage. I just read a great book about that, actually, that I'd recommend. I want to caveat that we're talking on April 2nd, 2025. So, you know, this stuff does get a little bit out of date over time. But Jeff Busbang, who's a VC at Flybridge in Boston, literally just like 2 weeks ago, released a book called The Experimentation Machine. And he's got some great ideas around some of the things that I was just talking about. That's awesome. And Jeff's a great guy. He's a good friend. So when
you're being pitched, and I have some of my own ideas, I think these should be. So we'll see what overlaps. What are the top 3 to 5 things you're listening for?
I always say when you're investing in seed, you're investing in the idea and or you're investing in the person, right? Like, you need to be passionate about at least one, if not both. And so those are the things that I'm looking for, right? Like, what are the signals that this is a product obsessed founder, right? That this founder is going to run through walls, that this founder is open to feedback and, you know, and coaching. Is this someone I want to be working with for potentially the next 10 years, right? Because that's, you know, not an uncommon timeframe from pre-seed to exit. So those are the things I look at on the founder side. On the product or idea side, is it something that I think is interesting? And by resonate, I don't mean is something I would personally buy. That's a mistake that I think a lot of investors make. And I think that's not what I'm saying. But do I think that in the market, it resonates? Have they done that initial research? Does it make sense that this product could result in a really big company, right? And really, I mean, companies take this journey from like feature to product to something beyond that, right? Platform or, you know, mm-hmm. company, whatever. And I think it's a mistake to think at the seed and pre-seed stage that you're building maybe even product or it's certainly not platform or company. Like, you're building a feature. Is this a feature that someone is going to say, yes, I think this is important. A buyer is going to say, yes, I think this is mm-hmm. important. And it's going to make my life so much easier that I'm willing to pay for it. And that's what I'm really looking for at that stage.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've got a friend of mine in Atlanta who came to me with an idea, and I may have actually even emailed you about it. I think, and it's a competitor to something else. I'm not going to mention what it is.
And yeah, that's right.
I said to him, well, what's going to make these people leave company A for your company B? Like, you've got to go out and do research is exactly what I told him. And, you know, you have to start reaching out to the people who are using this product for one thing and ask them, you know, I mean, we went over a whole like list of things, right? And then depending on what you hear back, then you can think about, because he's going to fund it himself to build it. And I think that, you know, it could work. Maybe it won't work. I think he's getting some good feedback from here on out. But, you know, in listening to you talk about, you know, the idea or the person, right? You know, it may start out as a feature before you even know, is it a company, is it a platform, what is it? And, you know, the first thing I think about on an idea is this something people need or something people want?
Sure.
Right. So,
and the difference is really important, right?
That?
Well, because
I believe I know what the importance is.
The cliche way of saying it is like, is this 10x better, right? Like, that's what VCs ask. It's like, is this 10 times better or 10 times cheaper than the alternative?
Yeah.
And the reason that that people phrase it that way is that it can't just be a little bit better. People don't switch. People are very fixed in their ways, right? They don't switch for like, yeah, this is a little bit better. Like, if you're going to make the effort to learn something new, to switch it out, to sign the new contract, to whatever, download the new thing, it has to be substantially better, right? So, I mean, whether that 10x is 10 or 5, whatever, it needs to be a lot better. And I think that's the thing to sort of seek out in the market. And you know, I think there's no substitute at some point for just having product developed something that you can actually ask people for money for, because people are notorious for saying, that sounds great. Yeah, of course I'd buy that if that comes out. I mean, I get those sorts of things from founders all the time. And you're
exactly what we talked about.
That doesn't mean anything, right?
No,
like what means something is, hey, I built this and I have three customers. And, you know, maybe I think eventually I can sell it for $10,000 a month and I'm only selling it for $3,000 a month, but these people are actually paying me money for this. That exchange of value is really, really important. And so look for those opportunities at the earliest point in your business. One, because then, you know, maybe you don't have to raise as much money because you're finding some success in the market, but most importantly, because you're actually getting validation, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's really important.
You know, I think for a lot of first time founders, it can seem really overwhelming and even maybe exclusive, kind of a world to enter. I'm looking for venture capital. You know, what steps would you recommend they take to break in to that world in hopes of being funded? Because, you know, you send a million emails out and maybe one person responds to you. Like, what's the best way to increase potentially the probability, or is that even a possibility given different firms do different things?
Yeah. Well, no, of course it's a possibility. And I think it starts with what you just said, different firms do different things. So do some research, right? Then it starts with not doing the thing you joked about, which is send a million emails, right? Like, you're so much better to send out 30 highly tailored emails, yes, where you know exactly who you're emailing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how seldom this happens, because it's not that hard to find information on, you know, on me, for example, because I'm on the receiving end of a lot of these emails. I mean, I have a rule. I respond to every email that I receive, except when I get a dear investor or I'm blind copied on something. And I'm just like, why? Like, sending an email to a million VCs on blind copy, you might as well just not send it, right?
Yes.
Send something that's thoughtful, that shows that you know something about them and their investment thesis. Yes. Don't do the dumb thing, which people often do, which is like, hi, I see you're an investor in pick two high profile portfolio companies I've found, you know, Whoop and whatever. And I would love to talk to you about my thing, totally unrelated to that, right? Like, that's just like, okay, I got it. You went to my website for 32 seconds and you figured out that there are a couple logos there. Do something much more specific. Hey, I know that you're an investor, or you were an investor in XYZ company. We're building that for this other market, or whatever, something. Or I saw that I listened to the podcast that you did with Carol and you were talking about this, and it made me think that would be a really good, like, I'm much more likely to respond in some substantive way. So that's thing one. Thing two is, if you have the network, and I want to be careful about describing this, because we respond to emails that we get over the transom all the time, and we actually invest in companies where we had no other relationship with the founder. So I don't want to give the impression that, like, you have to be networked in. But if you do have connections to either the VCs directly, or let's say through your lawyer or an accountant or someone like that, some service provider that you work with, it is helpful sometimes to get an introduction, but the introduction should look just like I described those cold emails, which is there should be something targeted about it. Not just, hey, Carol, I know you know Seth, would you introduce me? Hey, Carol, you know, Foundry's invested in these three businesses that I think are really germane to this thing that I'm building. Would you mind introducing me to Seth? I'd really like to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
So those are ways that you can get in front of VCs. And, you know, the truth is, there are all sorts of reasons why. I mean, Foundry, we like to say we see about 8,000 investment opportunities a year. I don't know if that's exactly right, but, you know, what is more than several thousand. And we do maybe 8 new investments a year, right? So, you know, you got to find the right partner at the right time. You know, that takes some effort and a little bit of luck. And I think you need to recognize, like, sometimes you get turned down because it's like, you know, I just got back from traveling for 2 weeks. I just closed on a new project, you know, 4 weeks ago, and I'm just like, you know, absolutely like drowning, and I'm not looking at anything new. And you know, if you'd written me 6 months later and it was the right, and sometimes that's just luck, which is why you do have to go cast a little bit of a net, right? Mm-hmm. So not your million, but, you know, at least, at least a few dozen to try to get those substantive meetings.
I think that when I get those horrible emails, I'm not sure if it's just, or if it's both of these things. A generational thing with, you know, Gen Z, or a laziness.
Yeah.
Or a combination of both, because you know, when I send out emails, I don't send out a lot of cold emails, but when I do, I spend time. I just had this conversation with my chief of staff today, in fact, somebody where I was thinking about maybe having on the show. And she said to me, you know, this guy's posting he doesn't post anything, but we're hiring, we're hiring, we're hiring. And she says, what do you think about, you know, actually reaching out to him about, you know, X, Y, and Z? And I said, yes, draft up the email. Let me look at it first. Right. Because it's personal.
Yeah. And it's a reflection on you. Right. And I think that that's really important. I don't know. I mean, you and I are the same age. We sound old when we complain about young people these days, but I do sometimes feel like, look, there is a level of, I don't know, I don't want to say perfection, but at least a level of effort that is required. And if it doesn't look like someone put that level of effort in, I mean, I used to also have a rule, like when you spell my name wrong, I don't respond. When you have a glaring typo in your email, those are emails I don't respond to.
I agree.
Because I'm like, look, if you couldn't take the time to be careful about it, then it doesn't feel like it's deserving of my time.
Do I really want to make an investment in you?
Yeah. And by investment, I mean, literally the investment of time, the 2 minutes it takes me to write the response email. But I actually think that that's really important, because I feel like, look, if you didn't make that investment in the thing that you send me, why should I make an investment in sending something back? And again, this is from someone who has a general rule of like every email I receive that asks for a response, I respond to.
Right. I mean, I don't respond to every email because most of those are pitches, right? Same thing with LinkedIn and, you know, hi, my name's not even on it, I'm so impressed by the work you do. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Just generic. Right. And that's what I'm talking about. Generic. Like, it's easy to see through. Right. And this is just what you're describing. LinkedIn is very challenging. Cause I probably have 500 requests outstanding at the moment. It's just like hard to go through. And I keep going back and forth between like, should I just accept everyone and just, you know, then I potentially have my network? Do I accept people with interesting jobs? Like, I don't even know anymore. But when people email me in LinkedIn, like, I just don't check it. And so I kind of miss it. Now, maybe other professionals spend more time in LinkedIn, so it's not as big a deal to them.
That's a really hard thing, because I have noticed even people that I know, if I reach out, sometimes when I reach out to email, lands right in their junk mail.
Yeah, that's tough.
So, you know, sometimes you have to.
But thoughtful emails generally don't, right? I mean, there is something to it. Like, if you send 100 of the same emails, then you actually do get caught up in some of these spam filters.
Well, no, but I'm talking about sending one email to confirm a meeting.
Wow. And that doesn't get through.
Our conversation today. How did that land in your junk mail, right?
Yeah, really.
So sometimes you have to take a multifaceted approach. That's all I'm saying. What are some of the mistakes? I mean, we already just talked about one founders make when getting funded.
Yeah. Well, meaning after they get funded then, or in the process after they get funded?
First of all,
they spend the money too fast, right? Like it's burning a hole in their pocket. And, you know, I'm a big believer in methodical bets. What is it that we, you know, I often talk to my founders about, I call it the guardrails and goalposts conversation, right? The guardrails are how much capital are we willing to spend over what period of time? And then what's the goal, right? And that goal is the goalpost. And we talk a lot about what that is. So we're very clear, like we, you know, as a VC, I don't operate businesses, and I'm really in the influencer game, not the decision-making game.
Yeah.
And so I use that as a way of saying, look, let's just level set what's an appropriate level of spend and what are we trying to accomplish? And that takes us a while to like agree on that. And then as long as we're operating within those bounds, it feels appropriate. And I think you don't need a VC to do that, right? Like you can do that with yourself and say, okay, what am I trying to accomplish over what period of time? And how much am I willing to spend to do that? And an ancillary conversation that we often have is how much money are we willing to risk on any random experiment? And, you know, if you raise $200,000 in your seed round, that might be $1,000, right? Like, I'm willing to do a marketing thing and I'll spend $1,000 on it, but I'm not willing to spend two until I know it. I think it's working.
Right.
Right. And then over time, as you build the business, hopefully you have a little bit more money in the bank, you know, that grows. So maybe that's $10,000 and you're willing to risk it. But reminding yourself, and eventually it's 100,000 or maybe even more than that, reminding yourself what that is at various stages of the business can be really helpful, because sometimes you're reluctant, like it happens on both sides. Like sometimes you spend too much. That typically happens in hiring people. You hire too quickly. You're not discerning enough. This is obviously your world. You could talk more about it than I can. That type of spend, I've seen over and over, founders are very loose with that spend. And then they're almost overly tight with like programmatic spend of some kind, marketing spend, things like that. Mm-hmm. Right. And so on the one hand, they're wasting money because they're hiring too quickly. They're layering on people into the organization too fast to get everyone really working together. And then on the flip side, their go-to-market is being strangled because they're not willing to spend $5,000 or $10,000 to experiment on something, or when something looks like it's working, mm-hmm. to scale it up just a little bit.
Well, and I have to imagine you have this conversation with them before you decide to give them any money.
Yes.
Okay. Always. So you know, I so often see founders, I kind of call it founder syndrome, where they are just doing so much extra work that they could have somebody else doing for them. And I'm kind of curious as to, you know, it's like the, why are you spending your $1,000 an hour time doing $75 an hour work?
Yeah.
And I am curious as to your opinion on that, because I could tell you story after story. I've, you know, this recently a founder, she's like, yeah, I'm actually the full-time this and the full-time that. And I'm thinking, why?
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
I just had, so funny you bring this up, Carol. I just had this conversation with a founder yesterday, and he was explaining to me that like, he was like tapped out. And I was like, well, what's, you know, causing all that? He's like, I'm applying for tax credits and grants. And, you know, I mean, truly his company is like him and 12 engineers.
you're right. So.
And, you know, he's like, what should I hire next? I was like, you need to hire some admin support, right? Like that's really your next hire. Now, in his case, that might not be admin, like assistant style. It might be something else. But when we were building Foundry, I'm going to say in about 2012, we had raised two funds. The markets were super hot. We were doing a million things. We were about to go start raising our third fund. And the four partners at Foundry came together and we were just like, we are broken. Like it is like, this is too much. We're all traveling too much. This is back when board meetings were monthly, a bunch of other stupid mm-hmm. things that we also fixed. But it was just like not scaling. Like venture is not a scalable business. And we had this idea that we weren't going to hire associates and analysts because that we wanted to do our own work, which for us made sense and still continues to make sense. But at the time we were like, should we revisit that? And we started really going through like, well, what are we spending our time doing? And we realized that like a certain amount of that time was just truly administrative. It was in some cases booking travel and, you know, just things that are relatively easy to outsource. And we realized that the initial way for us to get more scale was to offload those things. It's exactly what you're describing. If you're worth you're a founder and your time's worth $1,000 an hour, why are you spending time doing $75 an hour things? Mm-hmm. And by the way, that was back in 2012. We found some very easy ways to offload that. There are way more easy ways now to offload that, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you can get a part-time assistant that are excellent and will even be in your email and all the things, you know, for a few thousand dollars a month, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. not that hard to do. And for some people, that can be absolutely life-changing. Now, over time, as the CEO, right? Initially, you're the head of sales. You're probably the product manager, right? You do all these other things. Eventually, yes. you need to work yourself out of all of those roles. Mm-hmm. So you hire some salespeople and you get other people other than you just selling. Eventually, you hire a head of sales and have them managing the sales team. So you don't have to do that anymore. Eventually, you hire a product manager of some kind, right? And someone, maybe it's not even a VP of product management, mm-hmm. but it's director of product management, someone right. who can translate that vision. Like, and your job ultimately as the CEO is to like work yourself out of every job at the company. Right. So your only job is working on the company, right? And then you're hiring and you're exactly. thinking about org and you're looking around corners and you don't actually have like day-to-day work in any of the departments. And by the way, every single one of the people that like leads each of those sort of functional areas of your business better be better at it than you are. Otherwise you didn't hire the right person.
Well, yeah. And that happens, right? So, you know, I mean, how much help can you or do you even provide when it comes to somebody saying, yeah, now I need a head of sales or now I need that, you know, head of product management or whatever that job might be, because they're not an expert at that. And that's probably not your expertise. I mean, you probably know a little bit about that. And then, you know, instead of hiring somebody, it's not that you got to go out and hire a retained firm or, you know, whatever, but there's ways to fractionally hire somebody, for example, that knows what I know. And so many companies don't ever want to do that. And I'm curious about that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's lots of ways to find talent. And so, you know, I mean, I guess back to your question, if you do have to take money from VCs, what do you get? Well, one of the things you get is this, right? You get a certain amount of expertise in hiring. We've, you know, again, if you've been in VC for a little while, you've hired a lot of heads of product, heads of sale, all that kind of stuff. So there's a network there, right? So maybe you don't need to use a retained search firm because there's a network and you can go out to that network. So that's thing one. If you do have to use a retained search firm, hopefully there is a network of retained search firms that your VC has used, of course. So you're not starting from ground zero and you know what to expect. And and frankly, the search firms tend to be very responsive to VCs because they have done multiple engagements with them. And so that is also very helpful. And then of course there's help in the interviewing process as well. That doesn't need to be every VC on your board needs to interview every direct report of yours. That can be a subgroup of people, but yeah, I'm not a product manager, but I've hired a lot of product managers. So that's helpful, right? So, and then of course also VCs have a network of people who can help interview too, right? So if you're high, it's a critical hire and it's not something I can like, yeah, I can give you a read on them, but you know, I really am not like the best person, but I know 10 people who have had this job at $100 million organizations. And one of them, you know, has time to do a half an hour interview and give you a read. That kind of thing also can be helpful. And I think, you know, the days of like three people get in a room and we meet with one candidate, like that doesn't happen anymore, right? You work on projects together, you do a series of interviews. Mm-hmm. You've got, sometimes there's like take home projects, things like that, depending on what the role is. Mm-hmm. And then you leverage your network and have other people talk to them, even if that's only for 15 or 30 minutes to get some other perspectives and also get the candidate in a few different situations, right? You know, sometimes it's over Zoom. Sometimes it's face to face. Sometimes it's the morning. Sometimes it's the night. Like, you know, you can't judge someone in a couple of just a couple of quick conversations. And this is what I was saying about like founders are often so quick to spend money hiring when they're so loath to spend money on programmatic. But I think they should be really slow as they think about bringing people into the org because it's expensive.
That's right. Not only is it expensive, it's more expensive when it doesn't work out.
100%. And I'm sure you see this all the time. I can only imagine what percentage of your practice is like, hey, how do we work with teams that aren't working well together?
Well, it really is. And I'm really glad to hear you say about how, you know, you'll pull somebody out and say, can you spend a half an hour, you know, interviewing this person, right? Because I have done this for clients as well, where they bring me in at the end of this and say, Carol, I'd like you to interview my three finalists or my two finalists or whatever that might be. And this is not me, you know, breaking my arm, patting myself on the back, but this must be about 2 years ago now, I think, one of my clients had done this and she'd hired a retained firm in town here in Denver. And I thought it was a huge mistake, the firm she hired, but you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
And this was a founder. These were like two executive level searches. I would have done them for her. I know her very well. And I would have, you know, worked something out, but she didn't want to spend the extra money. And I'm like, if you told me that, I would have even lowered my fee for that.
Yeah.
So that you
yeah.
would have gotten it done the right way. One of the things after 9 months still hadn't closed.
Yeah. And imagine the cost of that.
I think
about the incremental money she was trying to save.
Angry with her for being so penny wise and pound foolish.
Absolutely.
I said to her, I could guarantee you now it would have been done. First of all, we would never have made the offer to the person that then dawdled around for the next 7 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who does that?
No. And who on the receiving end of that keeps the offer open? I mean, it's just crazy.
Oh my God. So when she told me, I was just like, oh yeah, yeah. But you know, ultimately all three of the finalists that I interviewed all said to me and said to the founder, the conversation they had with me was exponentially more valuable than the ones they had with the search firm.
Yeah.
And I thought, I just shook my head. I thought, what is wrong with people?
Yeah. Yeah.
How are you retained and spend this kind of money and you don't put the effort in to actually get to know someone? Forget about the qualifications for a minute, Seth. Okay. Yeah. Who's like you said, the idea and the person. The person is the one you're going to be spending the time with.
Yeah.
Whether you're hybrid or in the office, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's just a reminder. There's no easy button, right? Like, you have to do the work.
No. Makes me crazy.
No, it's frustrating because, again, the cost is so high, yes. Right? Like, you're being penny wise. The founder is being penny wise in that instance and pound foolish because, you know, it looks like they're saving money. They're going with a cheaper, whatever it is, right? They're doing it over a longer period of time. But the truth is, especially when you're hiring go to market, but really any position, like when you need that position, you need it. You need it right away. And finding a way to fill it with the right person as soon as you can, that is so much more valuable than, I mean, I can't imagine dwaddling around for nine months.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. But as you know, people don't always take the advice you give them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I said it to you, but like, I'll emphasize it. Like, we're in the influence business, right? Like, basically all I do all day, every day is give people advice by which I mean, I don't actually get to make very many decisions. I think people think VCs sit there and they kind of pull the strings on these businesses, but like, there's very few times when I actually get to say like yes or no. Right. Yeah. And so most of what I do is like, I'm in the influence game and I'm giving advice, and you know, the power comes from whether my advice is good advice and whether I'm effective at delivering.
Well, I think influence is the key word here, right?
Yeah.
And you cannot, because once you've given them the money, you know, yes, you may be sitting on your board, but you're only one person and you don't own 51% of their company.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to be able to influence someone. The power of being able to do that, you know, and, you know, yes, your advice is very good. You've been doing this for a long time, but you know, there's people out there that are like, I know better.
Yeah. And look, I mean, people don't take my advice all the time,
what
right?
Are you gonna do?
And they don't take your advice. They don't take your advice, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, the board ultimately could fire a CEO if they didn't take their, you know, she or he didn't take board's advice enough. But I mean, I see VCs making the mistake all the time. And when you come in heavy handed, all you end up doing is like, you get pushback because people just sort of dig in and, you know, you're so much better sort of really understanding the framework, understanding the question thoroughly, interrogating it a little bit, like what, you know, what are you thinking as the pros and cons, and then finding a way to frame your advice in a way that feels, you know, reasonable and researched and ultimately actionable.
Well, and not just that, Seth, you know, for me, if I'm investing in a company or in a person, right, whatever that is, I really want to know, what do you want out of me? What do you know, I know you want the money, but I have so much more to offer you than just the money. What do you want from me? What do you need from me? Where can I bring value to you?
Well,
I would say, I hope all venture capitalists are asking, as they get further down the line, asking those questions of people.
Circling back to your original question around seed financing. Like, this is actually an important part of the process on the company side of working with potential investors is both finding investors that can bring something to the table other than money, but also being super clear with them that what part of why you're reaching out to them as an angel investor is because there's something else that they bring to the table. Right. Everyone wants to feel like there's something that they're needed for other than just money at that stage. And being deliberate about that, I think, is really important. Will make you, I mean, you know, you're an angel investor. Like, I assume it makes you more interested in a company if they say, hey, Carol, we really need help with these organizational activities. And we know you're an expert at that. So, yeah, we want your 25K or your 100K. But, you know, we also really need your help in these areas. And I'm hoping you'll be a partner there.
And I often get pitches, whether it's email or LinkedIn, and, you know, on the ones that I respond to, because I don't respond to all of them, of course, some of them are just horrendous. That's what I want to know. Well, yeah, sure, I'm happy to hear, but, you know, what do you want from me other than money? And if you know, I'm happy to have that conversation with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.